The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Hello and welcome to Squawkbox. Here are your headlines today. ECB staff discuss strike action after rejecting a below-inflation pay offer, as the central bank's own survey shows price pressures are set to rise next year. Hong Kong's Hang Seng jumps on local media reports. Authorities are considering a further easing of COVID measures, with tech stocks leading the charge.
Crude prices recouping a little bit of their losses after sinking to their lowest level this year, way lower than what they have been at the start of the war. Whilst China's President Xi Jinping starts his three-day visit to Saudi Arabia in a bid to boost ties with the region.
The S&P 500 posts its fifth straight negative session as rate concerns cloud the outlook, while consumer borrowing climbs. But National Economic Council Director Brian Deese tells CNBC the economy is still robust.
The United States is incredibly well positioned to be the place where investment, productivity and innovation happen.
Morning. You know what today is, don't you?
Go on.
It's finally the last day.
It's finally Karen's last day around the set.
It's finally your last day of the year.
2022, I am.
How many times have we done this?
Six, seven? We started late last week.
We forgot the start of this week, but now we're back on the message again.
Friday we started.
So are you off today or tomorrow?
Today.
Wow, you packed?
Yeah, I've been packed for a while.
And if you're going up the twirly staircase and turning left with a glass of Dom Pom?
Well, one likes to be comfortable.
good.
But I am going to miss both of you,
good.
Though.
Oh, happy Friday.
And the viewers.
Yeah, and happy holidays.
Yeah.
Well, Karen's obviously extremely happy about the fact that she's heading off to sunnier climes, but the staff over at the ECB are not so happy,
Seems. Should we tweet to give the backstory to our viewers about this one? Because there's a lot
is
of...
Is there a backstory?
Well, there is a backstory. I'll let them under the... Under the skirt to the ankle of what's going on at CNBC.
I'm not sure you can use that phrase anymore.
Can you not use that phrase?
No. Very racy for the ECB.
Didn't it used to be in the...
What's that?
In the bad old days.
In the bad old days of misogynism and so on and so forth.
No, it was the 20s. Yeah, exactly. It would just be showing an ankle, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Can we not say that?
I'm not sure what we can say these days. Most of it seems to be off limits to someone.
But the point is, we've had a strenuous debate with Mike and the team and Britt and Dave and everyone about what our headline stories are today, because there's a lot of really interesting news out there, as is there is every day, but there isn't a kind of killer story. So, Jeff won.
Well, I don't know if I've won, but I just thought that this story, it has everything. It has human drama, it has markets, it has financial statistics. We'll get to the Kardashians later, because I believe there is a story
about the Kardashians a bit later on.
But I mean, this is delicious, isn't it? You know, we talk a lot about inflation and its impact on workers, and there's industrial action breaking out everywhere at the moment, and it's not just in Europe. It's not just in the UK, it's in the United States. Even some of our colleagues at the New York Times are now walking off the job because they're not happy about the pay settlement.
So do we call it the mince pie indicator, not the McDonald's indicator? It's right on Christmas. It's costing them more to buy mince pie. They're going to get a smaller mince pie as a result of what's happening around the cost of living crisis.
The British trade union leader, who is most vilified by government...
Mick Lynch.
They're calling him Lynch the Grinch, which just carries on with your Christmas thematic. Go on, tell people the story.
All right, here we go. Staff at the European Central Bank are apparently threatening to go on strike after refusing a pay rise offer of just over 4%. That is less than half the rate of inflation in the Eurozone. Union officials reportedly met with ECB President Christine Lagarde, where she's believed to have made clear there would be no further salary negotiations. Now, the irony, this comes as the ECB's own inflation survey showed consumer prices are expected to rise 5.4% over the next 12 months. That's up from 5.1% from the month before. Inflation is expected to decline gradually over the first half of 2023 before disinflation picks up pace towards the end of the year. Inflation estimates for the next 3 years remain unchanged at 3%. That's well above the ECB's 2% target. We've talked a bit about the strike-related story here. I think it's worth just blending in some of the other economic information that we've had here, because we've got, what is this? The third down session for European markets, the fifth down session for American markets. I think we're beginning to ask the question now of whether the markets are beginning to roll over because they recognize some of the early signs that recession is beginning to emerge on both sides of the Atlantic. You were having a look at some of the credit-related data in the United States. My understanding is that household debt in the US is now well in excess of $16
trillion. $16.7 trillion was the latest data 3 weeks ago.
So that is a big number. What is that in terms of every household? I mean, something like $30,000 to $40,000, I think, per household. But what are the latest numbers telling us?
So you want revolving credit data?
Yeah.
So the latest consumer credit data out of the US showed $27.1 billion increase in October. So that's a big number, but it's nowhere near as big as the biggest figure of the year, which was a $45 billion increase back in March. So that in itself is inconclusive. It's a much bigger figure than the average figure before COVID. The average monthly increase was $15.4 billion. Mm. This is a significant amount more than that, but lower than the high. So inconclusive. But what seems unambiguous, and I say seems unambiguous because it's only one data point, is that once again, the revolving credit figures are picking up. And I know the team have been good at putting together a few boards and that on the revolving credit. It's over 10 billion. There is a slight contention about whether it's 10.1 or the Federal Reserve website page that shows 10.4. But either way, we're talking about hitting a new all-time high. Now, this is fascinating. A, because of what you were talking about household debt, and B, because there are an awful lot of economists out there who are talking about excess wealth held by households, excess savings, somewhere in the region of 1.7 trillion. But if all was well on the excess savings front from households, we wouldn't necessarily be seeing record revolving credit data. And record revolving credit data includes credit cards. We all know that the average rate of credit card interest rates in the United States is somewhere in the region of 19%. It's been ticking higher, of course, as interest rates gone up, but it's somewhere in the region of 19%. So it is one of the most inefficient ways of borrowing money if you can borrow cheaper elsewhere. So one, does that show something about liquidity conditions, about the availability of credit elsewhere before families are putting money on credit cards? And two, and this is the eternal question where people like Cole Smead and others and I, and we've been having these debates, is if the household savings are so robust for median families and average families rather than the total, which is either skewed by the rich at the top, why are people putting so much money, record amounts of money, on credit cards? And I don't think we necessarily have an answer yet.
A necessary erosion of wages, real incomes, I think, is the answer here. I mean, and then all these stories are linked. So if you consider why the ECB has not pushed forward with a sizable increase that matches inflation, it's because they're worried about second round effects. And there's lots of reports where they go back over history and they're looking at the 1970s on the OPEC oil embargo and say at that time,
absolutely,
effectively, you saw a slightly different outcome. Here's a line. The difference is that real consumer wages declined after the recent rise in energy inflation, while they strongly increased in the 1970s. And I think that's the issue. A lot of policymakers keen not to make a policy error that was similar in other energy situations. And if you keep on pushing wages up, then you trigger those second round effects. And already we've got stubbornly high inflation in so many parts of the world. Unfortunately, one of the unnecessary or one of the necessary casualties here could be the credit side. It's the health of the finances of health of households, because the only way to protect them would be to increase wages so that they're not feeling the impact. But then you get this spiral again of inflation. So unfortunately, the data that you bring forward of the credit side, the housing data we've been seeing lately, some of the weakening in retail sales, that is all exactly what central banks want to see, because it means we're not triggering second round effects on inflation.
Funnily enough, we were, you know, talking about showing some of the backstory and some of the working out. We were also having a conversation about financial repression in the newsroom this morning, because ultimately, linking back to the ECB story, with inflation running at the number that it is, any pay settlement at the moment that doesn't reflect that inflation number is basically employees being left behind somewhat when it comes to prices and when it comes to household income. The problem is, as you say, there is a great fear, because if we know anything from our economic history, we know that a wage price spiral isn't a good outlook for markets, for economies, for individuals. There have been enough, I think, scenarios through history to tell us that inflation is something that you really want to stamp out and you don't want to let it get out of control. The problem at the moment, it seems to me, is that the politicians, in spite of what they know about economic history, can't help themselves, because they all desperately need to get elected or want to get re-elected when their particular elections come up. And the one way to do that is to give money.
Largesse, yes.
To consumers, to try and fill the gap between inflation and where we are on pay. And the problem is that we also know from our economic history that that doesn't necessarily work. It only fuels that wage price spiral here. And the other thing we know from our economic history in the 70s is that price controls don't work either. And yet it's where a lot of politicians are going at the moment, because they think, like King Canute, you can hold back the tide by just implementing a price control that everybody then works around.
Which takes us to the point, are we looking at a policy error? Because I think that's what the markets have been responding to this week, instead of all the good news that perhaps things are not as bad as we thought, and maybe we've got some sort of Fed moderating the action on interest rate increases and a bit of the Chinese reopening story. I think investors are now going back to where they were earlier in the year, worried about some sort of policy mistake, that we're not going to have that Goldilocks recession, not too hot, not too cold, just enough of a slowdown to reset the equation. And I think there are question marks around that, and you're seeing that what will come back into the market as we look to close out 2022. And I think investors are right to ask that question. How much can you tighten an economy? I mean, inflation in the United States is coming down slowly at this point. That could again be put into question when we get the next CPI print. The unemployment levels, if they go up to 5%, I mean, what does that really look like in terms of delinquencies for banks and across the system?
Is that
going to be a soft recession or not? Is it going to be much worse than that?
Yeah, but we tried to ask about delinquencies of a ratings agency last week, and the gentleman in question refused to give us the view. They said, oh, well, they could be as low as 4% of delinquencies, but they may go up as high as 12%. Well, I said, well, that's useless for a start. That doesn't help us. So come and tell us what you think. Mm. Well, these are just our range of scenarios. So 4% delinquencies, pretty much historical norm. 12%, bit of a crisis, and represents a cyclical trough as well. It was the rating agencies refused to kind of help us out on that one as well. So maybe someone more useful on the rating agencies will come on the show and tell us what they really think about that. Because I agree with you, double digit delinquencies in corporates is a real and dangerous proposition. And the whole corporate debt market is something we're concerned about and should be concerned about. It is a great canary in the coal mine for greater problems elsewhere in other markets and broader in the economy. But again, the area, if we're going to make this a broader conversation as well, the other area we should all be worried about at the moment, and this show has consistently tried to look into, and we're getting kind of a straight bat response from a lot of people in those markets, is private sectors, not the public markets. The public markets are showing very well, as you mentioned, with the markets going down on a daily basis, what they think is going on with recession indicators. The private markets are very glib about it. These property funds, these REITs as well, they're very glib about it. The VCs, they're very glib about it. The private equity market, they are glib about it. Actually, those markets need to revalue and revalue fast, because the worry is that it's not only themselves they're going to hurt, it's all the pension funds that have invested into them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to remind people who maybe haven't following this very closely, in the very low interest rate environment we've had, institutions have tried to improve their return by stepping outside of the public markets. And we've had a lot of guests on who've talked about the opportunity in alternatives. Well, that represents property, it represents lots of other areas of the public markets that you don't necessarily have to mark to market on a daily basis. The problem is, as you're pointing out here, people will have overpaid in those days of near zero interest rates, and now there will be a repricing as interest rates rise, and that may have an impact on other parts of the portfolio that are in the public markets as well. So be very aware that there are two things here. There's a duration mismatch and there's a liquidity mismatch potentially here. I don't want to be incredibly negative though. There is one way we get out of this, and it's productivity ultimately. And there was a slightly better bit of data yesterday on US productivity, which suggested perhaps that productivity is picking up here. And just to mention another story that we may get into a little bit later on, apparently Elon Musk has his own plan for how Twitter improves its liquidity and productivity. You sack half the workforce and then you put beds in to get the remaining half to work twice as hard and sleep overnight. Or maybe that's not the plan.
Permitting for that?
That's not the plan, apparently.
I read a
line. Which bit? Oh, you can't sleep overnight in the offices?
The hotel room. No, well, I don't know about that, but the hotel rooms that have been created in the offices in former conference suites may not have permitting for a change of usage, which matters. Right.
This used to be part of history, though. You know, you think of entertainment industries. We used to always have beds on site somewhere because
Did
it
you?
Was... Absolutely.
What kind of entertainment industry are we talking about,
well,
Karen?
Television, where you worked all sorts of strange hours and some of it were double shifts because you were the face of a network and effectively you had to pull
back
a morning
in
shift.
You had a bedroom in the
there
office.
There were definitely beds around to lie and have a nap in case you were doing both ends of the day. Absolutely.
Really?
There is a story, I think, going back into the mists of time at CNBC about a boss turning up for a tour of the office and finding someone asleep in an editing suite. And that I don't remember that playing particularly well, to be honest.
Who was it?
Right, the opposite.
Yeah, let's not mention the name on air, even though the director's shouting it in our ear at this very moment.
Is he? Did he?
That one will remain a mystery.
I didn't even hear what he said.
Good.
He's not reiterating it, no. Okay, all right. The CEOs of two Wall Street banks, big banks at that, are warning of a slowdown amid weaker consumer demand. Check out CNBC.com. Also coming up on the show, reopening stocks catch a bid in Hong Kong on reports the government may ease COVID restrictions. We'll discuss.
And for more on potential strike action at the ECB after that below inflation pay offer, as well as the latest on COVID curbs easing in Hong Kong and China, you can check out the Squawk Box podcast.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
We have a line crossing from Shanghai at this hour. Shanghai city authorities will from Friday stop requiring COVID test checks for restaurants or entertainment venues. So you can go into some of these entertainment facilities now without a test as of tomorrow. So exciting news for Shanghai residents, no doubt. Meantime, let's talk about some of those other restrictions. Hong Kong's government is reportedly considering scrapping its outdoor mask mandate and shortening the isolation period for people who test positive for COVID-19. According to local media reports, positive cases and close contacts would be subject to 5 days of isolation, down from 7. Any loosening move would be in line with measures announced in mainland China yesterday, less than 2 weeks after protests against Beijing's handling of the crisis swept across the country. China's National Health Commission will hold a briefing in little under an hour's time. A look at markets, the Hang Seng at this hour, you can see, is stronger, 2.6% higher. So the index bouncing at this point. Technology names, let's just see the makeup of those stocks and the contribution that we've got. It's solid, isn't it? Bilibili outpacing most, double-digit gains, 18%, but still very solid numbers on JD.com, up more than 5%, Meituan, more than 6% in the green. And to Macau casino stocks, there was a lot of trade in these around some of the recent changes. Wynn Macau soaring 20% higher. Some investors know they're happy to put bets on that based on this trade just in one day alone. SJM Holdings, another big mover, up 10 plus
8%.
Got to say, I see the big moves, but I do worry if there's a liquidity problem if they're moving that aggressively on these tentative stories. Xi Jinping has begun his three-day trip to Saudi Arabia in what China calls an epoch-making milestone for China-Arab relations. Well, let's see if it is an epoch-making milestone with Dan, who joins us now. Dan, good morning to you.
Hi there, Steve. Well, on Capital Connection earlier today, I asked one of our guests if he believes that President Xi sees opportunity in Saudi Arabia's recently fractured relationship with the United States. And the answer to that question was a resounding yes, because I think you only need to look at the optics of this trip to give you some insight into exactly just how warmly Xi was received here. Saudi Arabia seems more than happy to welcome President Xi with open arms. We saw fighter jets from the Royal Saudi Air Force escorting Xi's plane through Saudi airspace when he arrived. We saw aerobatic planes with green smoke trails greeting him when he landed. It's certainly a far cry from that really awkward fist bump that we saw between MBS and President Joe Biden when Biden was in Saudi Arabia earlier on this year. And that is a contrast that perhaps the Saudis would like to demonstrate here. It's a message to Washington that Saudi Arabia is willing to embrace strategic partners like China for the betterment of its economy and society in areas like trade, security, investment and business deals and beyond. Of course, we know that Saudi Arabia is the biggest US ally in the region. It is China's top oil supplier. And how the Americans react and respond to what they're seeing unfold before their eyes right now remains to be seen. President Biden has said that he doesn't want to cede US influence to Russia, Iran, or China in the Middle East, but he has few options to respond, you could contend. So how all of this shakes out from a geoeconomic perspective remains to be seen. What we're told, though, is that we will see significant deals, trade deals, coming out of this meeting worth in the order of about $30 billion. We're yet to get more detail on exactly what that looks like. And of course, President Xi is also underway with other summits taking place across, involving other Arab leaders from across the region as well. So a deepening of ties from China into Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Arab world unfolding right now, guys.
Dan, terrific coverage. Thank you very much indeed for that. And you lead us neatly into our conversation with Dr. Chen Xiaolin, Head of International at Crane Shares. Nice to see you this morning. Thanks for joining us. Maybe we can just pick up on that point. How critical is this trip, do you think, to the Middle East as far as the Chinese government is concerned?
Very important in many ways. It probably marks a very important milestone for China and between Arab countries in many ways, because I think, Karen touched base on early on the reopenings. This is a very critical moment for Xi Jinping. This is Xi Jinping's third international overseas trip for this year, or since 2020, I'll be honest with you. That actually shows Xi Jinping's move to restore his international or global leadership in many ways. That's number one. And number two, when People's Republic of China, mainland China, founded in 1949, this is the first ever, the highest level of diplomatic events between Arab countries and China. So you can see from a political point of view, it is very important milestones between the two. Economically, you could also mark is very important because China has very high trade or bilateral trade with Arab countries in many ways. I think last year they recorded the highest level of the trading, probably around $300 billion altogether between the two. And also China imported half of the crude oil from Arabs.
Right. And so as I look at this and I look at maybe the diplomatic nuances, does this send any message at all about Beijing's attitude towards Russia at the moment and perhaps a falling out of favor because of some of the nuclear threats that have been made by President Putin and various other Russian officials? Is this trip about showing the Russians that China has other friends that can supply energy?
I think this trip is less to do with China show Russia or the rest of the world. It's more of China itself focus on how it's looking for strategic partners in the rest of the world. I tell you a couple of examples. For instance, in this trip, Dan mentioned early on the $30 billion trade. That includes infrastructure, information, new energy, new technology. That just shows China is actively looking for partners in economic, terms across the world. If you remember, at the Communist Party Congress, Xi Jinping made an announcement or made a reiteration saying China will continue to focus on the One Belt, One Road initiatives. This is the, I believe, we will see how the deal get reviewed in a few days. I believe it will be heavy emphasis on Chinese corporates to go outside of China to build the infrastructure upgrade needed in the Arab countries. So I think it's more of like how they can export the expertise of Chinese domestic economics skills to the international world rather than anything else, in my opinion.
This trip coinciding with this reopening theme now in China that the markets have been moving on all week. And, you know, the view was that it was going to happen fairly slowly. But the announcements have been coming very quickly now. We just mentioned the Shanghai one, but not having any testing going into facilities that, quite frankly, had a lot of testing previously. So how do we think about the pace of reopening from the Chinese? Is it going to be faster than people expected?
I would agree with you, Karen. This will be a gradual and sequential process. But why the announcement come out again after 3 days when they remember when they initially announced the relaxation was in 11th of November, right? And now 3 weeks later, they announced another optimized 10 measures. I think it's more to do with the central government to make sure there's no miscommunication in understanding and executing of the new policy. You see the past of the people, how people is like, we are relaxing, why we still locked down? So the kind of, you know, social kind of, you know, conflicts. Now that what they do is they say, let's say, make it clear, this is the 10 measures you're going to implement across, you know, from the top to bottom local governments across China. But I think you're absolutely right. They make sure the policy message is very clear, but they will leave the local government to implement them. I think this reopening is happening, like we see, the remove healthcare QR code, the remove testing, remove PCR testing, all these things are happening with a very clear message. Reopening is happening, but you know it will be a gradual and sequential one. I think this will put a lot of tests on Chinese healthcare systems. The cases will go up. You already seen it has gone up. I will test the system if they are managed such situation well. Also, the elderly people, how they're going to roll out the vaccination for the elderly people to reassure a complete, a full reopen is down the line.
If we could just stretch to the politics here and what sort of threat the reopening poses to Beijing authorities and President Xi himself, because many of us are trying to reconcile how you go from one very strict policy to something that mimics the West for an authoritarian government. How do you do that U-turn without losing face or a sense of power over the people?
I think the Chinese government under a lot of pressure from how they see, you know, we deal with the situation locally here. That's number one. Number two, also the vaccinations choices become more available. Also the vaccine that they used in China domestically become more recognized internationally. So they have more confidence to say, let's vaccinate the elderly people. That's the second. Third, the economy is under pressure to recover from COVID strict measures, no doubt about that. I think they recognize that, and also particularly after the CCP, Xi Jinping set a very ambitious goal to modernize the society. That would mean China has to produce a 4 to 5% GDP growth from now on for a decade. How are you going to achieve that with a lockdown economy? I think all in all, they felt the results of continuous lockdown would probably weigh less in protecting life than probably sacrifice more economic growth. So I think the chances now is reopening is set. The goal, you have the target goal, but along the way, I'd say it's going to be a bumpy road.
It is going to be a bumpy road. And actually, I wanted to ask you about the bumpy Belt and Road initiative before you even mentioned it today, because it needs a relaunch, doesn't it? And it needs a reboot, because it has now been accused in some emerging countries of being part of debt trap diplomacy. And now, secondly, I'd say a lot of Western democracies have turned their back on the BRI and actually have suddenly decided, hang on a second, we don't necessarily want to do this, because you talked about bringing Chinese expertise in. Very often that's at the expense of local workers and local expertise. So it's Chinese workers and Chinese expertise comes in and it becomes a Chinese project as well. That is another one of the accusations. And my third point, which you can address all of this, is that the West is very concerned that this is about influence as well as creating economic links as well. And it seems that we are seeing now an EU and a US response to this, and perhaps remembering that perhaps they need influence as well in some of these regions.
economic influence is going to be a part of it, right? Because China is bringing investments, China is bringing expertise, and don't forget it's along 30 plus, 40 plus countries to get involved in the Belt and Road initiatives. It's not going to be an easy project to roll out. It will last for decades. But if you look at the Asia Development Bank, they estimate it's going to be, you know, billions of dollars needed for the infrastructure project to roll out in Asia in many ways. Does it need just Chinese expertise? I think China stands out as offering the expertise over, if you remember from probably the opener reform when Deng Xiaoping announced that policies from 1980s until 2010, China has focused on nothing over those 30 years but built its own country. So they really mastered in the skills of building infrastructure related skills, soft skills and hard skills. And obviously now China has progressed to a service driven economy. They have to let that part of the driver that matured in the economy to be used elsewhere. So with their intention of growing China, continue to rebalance the economy, they have all the intention to export. But you have rightly said does the neighbors need it, right, such skills? If you see how the Asia Development Bank focus, Asia infrastructure does need billions of dollars to rebuild its infrastructure to meet with the next generation's growth in the Asian, in the region to benefit from such. So it's going to be win-win situation, but not all the project will be economically viable to many people's eyes, many investors. I don't doubt about that. It's not all going to be very success, very immediate. You can assess economic wins in many ways.
Can we get a? Yes, oh, sorry.
No, go on.
Can we get a market call off you? Because sure. Seeing as you know you represent Crane shares as well, we've seen the Shanghai Composite trading circa 3,200 now. Had a solid bounce off its recent lows. Is the market, dare I say, very binary in its response to what's going on the COVID front? Is that the key driver, or is there something else we need to think about when looking at Asian and specifically Chinese stocks?
The rally so far, I think is sentiment driven. What I meant by that is a lot of the issues now get more clarities from the Chinese government. You got more clarities on COVID, you got more clarities on real estates, you got more of like a, you know, Karen was saying, the concrete measures to say now the COVID is reality to on the way of exit. So it's investment sentiment which has dropped to very low level over the last year and a half. Now to say the huge relief from the investor to say, I can expect China to back on their feet to track and grow their economy from here going forward. It's a lot of that drives, and also it's a lot of the reactions of oversold by the macro factor driven by other events. For instance, internet regulation, we didn't touch base on that. All of that has corrected. For instance, internet sector in China is right at the front and center of the regulations in internet. It's fallen almost 60% from its peak, right? And since the initial announcement of COVID relax, internet sector rebounded 23%. You know, just from that, it just shows investors now saying, you know what, the macro factor impacted performance so much, now giving me the clarity and the confidence to say, investors, maybe now is the time to look at fundamentals. And if you look at fundamentals, internet sector today, the forward PE is at 3 standard deviation below its 10 years mean. So it just shows fundamentally it's very attractive. Macro factor gave me the clarity, fundamental very attractive, investors are reacting to it.
There's a lot to unpack there. Look, thank you very much indeed for coming in and talking to us about the bigger factors and, of course, about the market itself. So we look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you so much indeed for your time. Chen Xiaolin, who is head of international at Crane Shares.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to CNBC.com.
Or join us again on the show with Jeff Cutmore, Steve Sedgwick and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.